The 1995 Sun Stand Symposium presents session number 250 on Knowing God, an essay by H. Wayne Scow with comments by Richard Ferry.
50 of the concurrent sessions. The title is On Knowing God, an essay. Before we start, I'd like to just welcome you to Sunstone and hope you're having a very wonderful time. If you haven't, some of you may have been able to attend more sessions than others, and I hope that they've been enjoyable and that you'll be able to attend more while you're here. I also want to remind you that admission to these sessions is by ticket or name tag only, and if you haven't had a chance to register, please do go out to the registration desk and support the efforts of Sunstone. I will only take a minute because we don't have a great deal of time and we want to focus on the meat of our presentation today, but I'd like to take a moment to introduce our two speakers today. First, we have Wayne Scow, who is a full professor of English at Idaho State University. He lives in Pocatello with his wife, Sandra, and they have four sons. He is the author of two books you may have recently heard about, Peculiar People, that he co-authored with Mary Beth Raines and his brother, Ron Scow, and another book about his son entitled Remembering Brad. When I asked him what we should say about him, he said, "Oh, just say that I'm something of a dilettante on this subject." When I asked Mary Beth Raines about him, she described him as someone who is very sensitive, a great editor, who is patient, has a wonderful sense of humor, and is dedicated to whatever cause he picks up. When I asked a cousin of his here in the audience, he said he's someone who has great compassion and understanding and is generous with his time. Our respondent will be Richard Ferry, who's a professor and psychiatrist of child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of Utah and also Primary Children's Medical Center. He and his wife, Janice, have three children and live here in Salt Lake City. I didn't have time to get too much of a scoop on him, but Mary Beth also had a comment about him, and she said he's been trying for years to work on issues of homosexuality and gender identity in adolescents and children within the context of the church, and that his courage and willingness to speak honestly has often gone unnoticed. So I'll leave you with those introductions, and we'll turn the time over to Wayne Scow, who will present his paper, which will be about 30 to 35 minutes in length. Then Richard Ferry will respond for about 10, 15 minutes, and at the end of which I hope we'll have time for questions from the audience. You may be thinking about those now.
I appreciate your coming this afternoon. It's such a big hall, and how's that? It's such a big hall that if in the spirit of dialogue, some of you who are seated further back would like to come forward, I think we might all be a little more comfortable, at least I would. I want to comment briefly in getting started about the title that I chose for my talk today, On Knowing God, an Essay. I mean to indicate some diffidence that I feel in addressing the subject with that title. It seems almost presumptuous, terribly presumptuously audacious, to think that one could say anything very meaningful about the supreme mystery in the universe. And I have no credentials other than an interest in the subject to qualify me to speak about it. So I thought if I said knowing God, that would sound as though I really did know. And I thought if I say on knowing God, adding the preposition, it will suggest just a little bit of an attempt to make a suggestion very diffidently or two suggestions and not be too presumptuous. I call it an essay in an old meaning of the word essay, namely that it is a very tentative effort, that it is a trial or an attempt. And so with those expressions of my diffidence, I will plunge into it here and hope that you will regard what I have to say as the first the first salvo in a dialogue that maybe can be pursued on this subject. I have an epigraph. It is the famous verse from 1 Corinthians in the 13th chapter, where Paul writes, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known." I take as my beginning premise the well-established Mormon doctrine that as God is, man may become. This formidable goal seems at once startlingly naive and hubristic in the extreme. In the view of most of the Judeo-Christian world, it is, in fact, heretical. But if we take this doctrine seriously, if we indeed aspire to the condition of godhood, it follows that we ought, here and now and perpetually, to be seriously committed to pursuing godlike perspectives and behaviors. To do so, we must learn by degrees to know God as fully as our mortal condition will allow. Clearly, this will be a very long evolutionary process, both from the standpoint of individual spiritual development and, as I will argue, from a larger cultural perspective. What does it mean to know God? When I was a young man of 20, teaching the first missionary discussion to any Danes willing to listen, we stressed the importance of understanding that God possesses a glorified material body which our bodies resemble. We taught that He is literally a heavenly Father, and as such, accessible. We didn't worry much about the mind of God. From my perspective at 20, knowing God seemed a simple, straightforward matter. Later, I myself would be schooled by another Dane, this one from the 19th century. His name was Søren Kierkegaard, and he offered passionately a radically different perspective on the God-human relationship. "God is infinite, and we are mere fallible mortals," he insisted, "and the gulf between the condition of the divine and that of finite humanity is so vast as to be objectively incomprehensible to mortals. Given that disparity, we cannot know God confidently, can only reach out to Him subjectively through an irrational leap of faith." If my youthful attitude and the Kierkegaardian posture are recognized as contradictory, which of them is correct? For me, there is not a single answer. I vacillate. On a given day, my assumption of divine parentage seems so easy and natural as not even to require thought. At other times, in other contexts, God feels infinitely remote and for me, like Kierkegaard, inaccessible except through irrational faith. But this much is certain. The problem of knowing God, at 20 I did not think of it as a problem at all, now seems to me a far more complex matter than it once did. Thus, though I am now more seriously involved in my quest for the divine than previously in my life, though I am eager to raise my consciousness and my behavior in small increments toward a dimly perceived godlike standard, I do so with larger awareness of the epistemological uncertainty that clouds my enterprise. Epistemology, you remember, is that branch of philosophy that deals with questions of how we know what we claim to know. From a personal perspective, in the context of my Mormon experience, I want today to speak of several complexities I have encountered in my attempt to know God. These concerns fall under two headings. First, impediments that arise from a failure to acknowledge the evolutionary basis of God's revelation, and second, language-based epistemological complications. First, the evolutionary basis of revelation. We believe all that God has revealed, all that he does now reveal, and we believe that he will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. Our ninth article of faith certainly suggests a gradual accretion of insight into the divine nature, mind, and will. This is entirely consistent with the unmistakable LDS doctrinal commitment to spiritual evolution. That is, that we are growing, if we wish to, toward a condition more like God. And yet the ninth article is not without ambiguity. This can be demonstrated by questioning how God's revelation actually occurs. It is useful to recognize that revelation, in its essence, is nothing more than high-intensity teaching and learning. In short, a pedagogical situation. God is teacher, mortals are the potential learners. Let us contemplate two possible pedagogical models that may be construed from our ninth article of faith. By pedagogical models, I mean assumptions of what is important in the teaching-learning process. The first model is a teacher-centered pedagogy. It focuses on the dynamic activity of God transferring efficiently his infallible knowledge to surprised, awestruck mortals. Once their attention is gained, the latter are obliged to register with exactness the objective universal truths God communicates and are held responsible accordingly. This is like the lecture method of instruction, with the aim being transcription of God's notes into the notebooks of obedient mortals. Prophets in this model resemble teaching assistants who help keep the students oriented and on task. There is definitely a final examination for the note takers and a hierarchy of grades based on compliance. One of the principal outcomes of this pedagogy is an insistent continuing veneration of the teacher and ongoing dependence on him. I believe that most Latter-day Saints interpret the ninth article in the light of this model. Whatever God revealed in the past is true, accurate, and unchanging. New revelation is not contradictory, but additive. Past prophets saw what was relevant for their times and, in proportion to their individual greatness, were granted comprehensive, objective, spiritual vision of the future. No true prophet was ever wrong in relation to the comprehensive scheme. The other pedagogical model, which stands in sharp contrast to the one just outlined, explains far more adequately, to my mind, the phenomenon of God's revelation to humankind. In it, God employs a learner-centered, discovery-based pedagogy. That is, the teacher maintains a low profile and shifts considerable responsibility for uncovering truth onto the learners. The emphasis is not on programmed lockstep imitation of the model. Rather, in a laboratory existence under conditions favorable to learning, God allows us to uncover significant questions about his mind and will and to formulate workable methods of weighing evidence relevant to these questions. This pedagogy admits risk and the possibility of error. After all, if you turn it over to us to sort of help it go, we are fallible. But what it lacks in efficiency is more than compensated by the benefits of creative involvement. Real personal growth is inherent in this participatory process, the aim of which is to empower the learner and ultimately make the teacher dispensable. Thus, God is not so much concerned with his own glory as with developing ours. In the second model, the seedbed of revelatory learning is our experience. God's truths and the truths about God come to us individually and collectively only as we have prepared the ground for his revelation to germinate. If our spiritual condition is underdeveloped, then God's ever-accessible revelation does not reach us because we are not open or able to receive it. In short, this latter pedagogical model privileges the role played by the receivers in the process of divine revelation. It sees revelation occurring or not occurring in proportion to the activity, preparation, and receptivity of the learners. In this view, the revelation Paul experienced on the road to Damascus did not occur because of God's arbitrary intervention. Rather, because Paul, in the very process of kicking against the pricks, was in fact preparing himself psychologically, was paradoxically removing obstacles that stood in the way of his grasping God's will. Assumption of a learner-centered divine pedagogy leads to a somewhat different reading of the ninth article. God's revelation in this view is not simply additive, nor infallibly received. Prophets and others are limited by the cultural context in which they live, as well as by their own subjectivity. New revelation becomes possible because individual and collective experience has demonstrated the limitation or even the fallacy of a former revealed truth. Note that in this process, it is not God's perfect objectivity that is inconstant. Rather, our receptivity waxes and wanes, partly because our attempts to know God and become like Him are tentative, experimental. Thus, the long process of human spiritual growth moves unevenly. If we stand back a little from the Bible and look for the larger lessons it contains relative to knowing God, if we open ourselves to its truth rather than imposing an exterior interpretive scheme on it, we see clear and striking evidence of evolution in the revealed nature of God. For the moment, I wish to concentrate not so much on the form in which the divine presence is perceived as on the mind, character, and values associated with God. In the earliest books of the Old Testament, the ancient Hebrews, like their neighbors, clearly worship power. Their God is perceived as potent in the ways of a tribal God. He has his favorites, his chosen few, whom he empowers in proportion to their fidelity, or punishes swiftly and harshly for lack of obedience. In an environment where rival tribes have their own gods, he is seen as intensely jealous, have no other gods before me. At times arbitrary, a privilege secured by his potence, and highly competitive. Consider all of the early instances when outcomes for the chosen people or for individual persons are presented as a trial of strength between Jehovah and his inferior rival gods. It is not until relatively late, at the time of David and Nathan, approximately 1050 BC, that we first begin to encounter references to God the Father, suggesting a more approachable, more predictable deity. By stages, then, through the latter prophets, the later prophets of the Old Testament, we come to the New Testament, where Jesus elaborates the concept, revolutionary by degree, of an altogether kinder, concerned, and loving Father. Or what man is there of you, whom, if his son ask bread, will he give him a stone? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your Father which is in heaven give good things to them that ask him? That's from Matthew, of course. Jehovah, as conceived early on in the Old Testament, might well have given stones, and not infrequently, on the basis of failed obedience. Consider, for example, Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt. The God of Jesus is concerned not just with the chosen, the valiant, the faithful, but with all. Not only the just, but the unjust as well. Not only saints, but sinners too, the small as well as the great, the weak as well as the strong. When the Apostle Peter understood his vision of the common and unclean beast to mean that the gospel of Christ should be preached to the Gentile nations, the larger significance was the implicit change in his concept of God, an internalization of the lessons Jesus had taught. God is God and Father, not just to the chosen people, but to all the inhabitants of the earth. From an evolutionary perspective, the importance of this realization relative to our human understanding of the divine can hardly be overstated. See, what I'm trying to say is that it is not God who changes, but as we learn to understand God better, our perceptions evolve, change, grow. One hopes become more accurate and more nearly objecting God's ultimate objective reality. If Jesus' teaching concerning a compassionate, loving, and long-suffering God seems a given to many Christians today, we must not forget how often in the history of Christianity over the past two millennia, the sterner concept of God has reasserted itself. Cotton Mather's famous 17th century sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God," represents a strong line in American Protestantism that seems more akin to the Old Testament view of God than that of the New, a line still vital today in more narrowly orthodox and evangelical corners of the Christian world. Thus, collective progress toward understanding God seems to move two steps forward, one backward. And now some comments about the language-based epistemological complications. For most of us, the effort to learn of God is largely indirect. That is, in the absence of direct private revelation of the divine, we focus on other persons, living and dead, whose testimony is authoritative, whose experience is compelling. Thus, the Bible seems a particularly promising source of enlightenment concerning God's being and will. And so it is, though not if approached by the simplistic proof-texting method I learned as a missionary. When I first began to read the Bible on its own terms, without an a priori agenda, I had to admit that it contained, in respect to God and the divine spirit, if not outright contradictions, then a multitude of highly ambiguous statements. To be sure, there were many references to God in anthropomorphic terms, but there were also frequent instances where the divine presence had been experienced in some other form: wind, spirit, cloud, pillar of fire, angel, etc. Moses' encounter with the Lord in the burning bush is a good example. Not only is God in appearance a, quote, flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, he is ambiguously referred to as both God and the angel of the Lord. A catalog of biblical texts referring to the divine presence would demonstrate clearly the difficulty, indeed impossibility, of arriving at narrow, conclusive, literal definitions about God if all of these scriptural texts are considered. How can we account for this scriptural ambiguity? To lay the blame on biblical mistranslation or misinterpretation is not sufficient, for the same inconclusiveness exists in other LDS scriptures. Rather, it is more helpful to reflect on the inevitable epistemological obstacle that scriptural revelation of the divine must confront, namely, the inadequacy of language to fully express our human experience. Here we encounter a paradox. We tend to think of language as a medium for giving form and clarity to our thought. Yet it is far from a perfect medium, and therefore its limitations impede as well as advance our understanding. Language is the unavoidable constricting medium through which our conceptions must pass. It is a bottleneck, or more aptly, in a famous Nietzschean metaphor, language constitutes an inescapable prison house that constrains the full freedom of our thinking. Perhaps in this context, language can be metaphorically conceived as Paul's glass, through which in this life we see darkly. Let us consider the ways in which language obscures our vision. We may begin with the problem of translation in relation to sacred texts. Our eighth article of faith proclaims the Bible to be God's Word as far as it is translated correctly. The general assumption is that its errors are the result of either linguistic ineptitude or lack of spiritual inspiration or both. In reality, the problem is not so much in the translators as in the nature of language itself, for the following reasons. First, every language is culture-bound, which limits the range of what it can express, and no two cultures are exactly the same. Every language relies heavily on idioms, which lack precise equivalents in other languages and in translation lose nuance. Second, no language achieves a perfect correlation between discursive description and the object as individually or subjectively perceived. Particularly is this so with abstract and intangible discourse. Third, even those who share the same culture and the same language cannot communicate perfectly with each other. Every individual's experience of his native tongue varies because our grasp of language is rooted in our individual life experience, and even closely related individuals have varying experience. For these reasons, not only is a perfectly equivalent translation of any complex text from one language to another simply impossible, even the possibility of two persons achieving a completely equivalent understanding of such a text in a shared language is theoretically non-existent. And texts in general are more complexly ambiguous than most people recognize. At best, we can arrive at acceptable approximations of the same meaning through language. Aside from these theoretical difficulties, the scriptural descriptions of deity are extremely problematic. Why are they not characterized, at least within the same language and culture, by greater clarity and consistency? Linguistic theory sheds some light on this matter. To a surprising degree, we describe our world and our experience in figurative language, in metaphor, metonymy, synecdoche, various kinds of figures. This happens because discursive language, the language of so-called ordinary discourse, so inadequately conveys the subtle substance of our intangible experience, including especially our emotional, spiritual, transcendent experience. In other words, our everyday language is more poetic than most of us realize. With figuration, we attempt to overcome the failure of discursive language by constructing understandable, non-literal analogies. To be sure, these are but linguistic approximations, but they are satisfying because, in linking the ineffable to everyday reality, they make the former roughly graspable and vividly felt. And after that paragraph, you probably said, please give us some examples. So I will do that. So ingrained, so deeply rooted is the habit, this habit of perception through figuration, that our language abounds in buried metaphors, expressions so common we frequently fail to notice that they are, in fact, figuratively. Consider, for example, the previous sentence. It would not occur to most persons that the words ingrained and deep-rooted and for and expression are all derived from metaphors. Consider another vivid, relevant example of how our spiritual discourse with abstract words is rooted in figurative speech. The word inspiration with its submerged metaphor. Spira from Middle English meaning to breathe, hence inspira or inspire, meaning literally to breathe into, hence figuratively to infuse with an animating influence. If God's Spirit inspires us, how appealing it is to conceive that experience as a literal in-breathing by and of the divine. Psychological as well as linguistic theory has recognized this extensive human propensity to apprehend the world through figuration. It is not simply that we seek a poetic way to express what we otherwise know. Rather, Non-literal figuration is essential to our cognition. It is the way our brains function. The relevance of this to the representation of God in scriptural texts, and for that matter in human minds generally, is clear. If we begin existentially with awareness of the divine, if we feel it, if we apprehend it as mysterious and infinite, yet powerful and present in our lives, we must find a way to convey our perceptions. And since discursive description largely fails us, the language-making portion of our human brains represents the ineffable divine, the mystery of the divine, through figures familiar from our experience. We project our knowing through what we already know. Thus, while we do not in this way create God, we do contribute substantially to creating our perception of the divine. We don't create God, but we do contribute to creating our perception. Accordingly, if the divine is perceived as being capable of thought and action, we conceive it in anthropomorphic terms understandable to us. If we are impressed that the divine will is revealed to us, we hear God's voice. In our attempts to grasp the mind of God, we attribute to him human emotions such as anger, jealousy, love, patience, emotional currency with which we are familiar. When we speak of God as Creator, Father, Lord, we are employing varied metaphors derived from earthly roles and relationships. The word Lord, for example, is not a literal translation from the Hebrew, but an old English word describing a powerful figure in feudal society. It is chosen by translators as a synonym for God because of its figurative appropriateness. If we idealize the divine as being loftily above us, we associate God with high places, such as mountaintops and clouds, and we say that God comes down from heaven. If we perceive God as powerful, we associate him with awesome forces we understand, with thunder, lightning, and flood, with supernatural magic such as changing staves into snakes. You remember that from Exodus. In short, we associate God with mastery over the material world if we want to emphasize the power. If we perceive the divine mastery as being mysteriously intellectual, we equate it with the Word, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. If we associate the divine power with fecundity, we link God with the feminine. At least this is so outside the Hebrew tradition. At other times, when in our perception of the divine we want to emphasize the ineffable rather than the anthropomorphically familiar, we turn to metaphors of a different kind. The divine intensity is experienced as fire or burning, as wind or spirit, that is, breath. Once we recognize these scriptural metaphors as such, their considerable and contradictory variety ceases to be problematic. We understand that it is not the literal terms of the figures that are being emphasized, but rather the elevated, powerful, fecund, creative, sheltering qualities of divinity. Instead of leading to confusion, such metaphorical richness helps us appreciate the mysterious, multifaceted, awesome nature of God. We can understand this in part by looking from another angle at the influence of figurative language on our concept of the divine. In the representation of our spiritual understanding as derived from the Bible and elaborated in many other religious texts, several overarching figurational schemes are identifiable. One of the most formative and dominant is that in which our spiritual lives are conceived in relation to a great military conflict. We are soldiers, fighting either on the side of good or evil. Christ and Satan are the opposing generals, to one of whom we must decide to give our allegiance. We are all enlisted till the conflict is over. We are marching on to glory, with, as we hope, a great reward in store. We must be ever vigilant and valiant, lest the enemy, the tempter, surprise and overcome us. We must keep our armor girded on securely. Our spiritual lives are thus fraught with danger and the possibility of everlasting perdition. The God who presides over this battleground will mete out swift and sure punishment to the unfaithful who fail in the great encounter. This familiar, elaborately developed military conceit, influenced by Genesis and Revelations in particular, reinforced by our subsequent religious literature, Milton's Paradise Lost, for example, and scores of our hymn texts, this elaborate military conceit does more than simply express our cultural perception of the divine. It helps to create in young minds a view of God and of our relationship to Him. Consider how different the effect on our perception if instead we choose to frame our spiritual discourse in a quite different metaphorical scheme. One not so pervasive, but nevertheless discernible in some corners of Christian literature. That our spiritual quest is an educational process in which, with God's loving support, we seek to broaden our experience through trial and error. This metaphorical model suggests that rather than coming to a terrible and final moment of judgment, our spiritual growth is ongoing, with possibility for eternal adjustment and progress. In this model, God is seen not as a stern judge or as a super combatant or contestant, but rather as a great and patient teacher. And we are not warriors in a defensive posture, but learners in an open and forgiving spiritual space. Clearly, these metaphorical models are incompatible with each other, although paradoxically they exist side by side in our religious texts. It's amazing that we don't talk about these inconsistencies more than we do. The ultimate objective truth about God, as implied by the one and the other, cannot reside equally in both directions. Not only will our spiritual lives be significantly different, depending on which of these models we find most influential, our very perception about God and the nature of the divine is altered. Ultimately, one's preference for one of these figurative systems over the other tells more about the subjective truth of the individual than it tells about the reality of God. Summary and implications. Human beings in general have an inherent need to discover the divine, to define themselves and order their lives in relation to it. In a broad cultural frame of reference, this discovery is not achieved quickly through a simple revelation, for the divine is complexly ideal. Rather, the human conception of God evolves gradually and somewhat irregularly. In primitive stages of culture, ignorance, impotence, and fear in the face of nature's power explain men's attempts to placate a severe deity, as Bertrand Russell argues in his famous essay, A Free Man's Worship. But as the experience of the race expands, the impulse to connect with God becomes an expression of our quest for the highest human potential. Our search for the personality of God is in actuality an attribution to God of our highest evolving values, a projection of the noblest ideals we in our cultural context can conceive. Such projection is the mechanism by which humans come step by step to know God. It is the means underlying God's learner-centered, discovery-based pedagogy. If in a primitive culture the highest good is power, worshipped in a context of abject fear, then that will be the principal element in the prevailing perception of God. If in a different age personal freedom is the highest good envisioned by mortals, then freedom will be central to the cultural understanding of God. If sexual sensation is paramount in the prevailing system of values, or creativity, or obedience, or personal serenity, or ascetic renunciation, or social justice, the divine will be envisioned, defined, and pursued in those terms. Let me provide an important and timely example. There is a strong tendency on the part of many just now to recognize and value the feminine. This impulse may be seen as a pendulum swing, a recognition that our world is, and has been for some time, dominantly patriarchal, that the feminine has been undervalued, and that some correction is both desirable and appropriate. Such an adjustment is tied to our evolving values of justice and enlightenment. It is not surprising, then, that many would project such desire by incorporating metaphorically the feminine into their conception of deity, that many would feel the need for a mother goddess as well as a father god. I myself feel comfortable envisioning deity in terms of both male and female. And if my prayer takes the form of communion with a heavenly mother as well as a heavenly father, that is my way of expressing also my gratitude and veneration for the mysterious gifts of life that I find embodied in wives, mothers, and daughters. It is a metaphorical projection of my search for God through the noblest values I can envision. It says that I mean to do God's work by recognizing the need for creative balance and wholeness in our human environment, that with my words and thoughts, I will strive to make such values prevail equally. In suggesting that humans pursue God by envisioning deity in terms of their own highest values, often figuratively expressed, I do not mean simply and cynically that, quote, man creates God in his own image, end quote, as the phrase is usually understood. That is, I do not mean that God has a separate existence except as a figment of man's imagination. I hold that the divine exists perfectly, ideally. But its revelation to us will occur only as we overcome, with God's help and with our own desire and effort, the obstacle. Given our current condition in mortality, Kierkegaard is probably right in some sense. We cannot know God completely, perfectly. But in pursuing our highest aspirations, our noblest thought, our most ethical and creative life, we are in the process of discovering the divine. We are on the evolutionary high road toward knowing God truly. The value of any particular figuration in terms of which groups or individuals imagine God will be directly proportional to the degree it motivates them to pursue that learning process intensely, optimistically, the degree to which it kindles desire to become like God. In this way, numerous figurative roads may lead some distance toward Rome. Thank you.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that. I think Wayne has done an exciting job of thinking about the way of coming to know God. And clearly, I think you might perceive that he chose for himself, you know, style two of learning here. He's on a search himself in that pedagogical method that he described, in which he is learner-centered, he is discovery-based, he is stretching to undercover truth, and to know in his own heart that learning comes from within himself as he searches to know God. And I think that speaks a great deal for the model. I also would like to suggest that metaphors are very dear to my heart. It's a constant coin of what I do in my therapy. If you don't understand the metaphors with which the people come to you and speak to you in, you're in big trouble. By the way, he caught me in my own problem. You know, he says you're revealed by the metaphors you choose. And over the last little while, I have been sitting in church constantly saying, now why do we have to sing this song? And it's always Onward Christian Soldiers. It's always Behold a Royal Army. It's, you know, marching on to glory. And I said, I just don't relate. I said, why do we have to sing about battles? I said, the closest I can get is Behold the Royal across the field. Now, that's about as close as I can get. I mean, I see myself as some kind of healer. I don't need to fight. And so we're sitting there singing these songs, and I guess, like you said, it reveals more about me than it does about God, because I'd rather sing a different song. So I think those kinds of understandings about how those metaphors reach into our lives and affect how we think about things are very true. Let's talk just, I want to make a couple of responses in the short time we have. One about the pedagogy. I really think that he's classified two, you know, polarizations of the process of learning. You know, obviously dealing with the prophet style, where we're getting the information from coming down, and of course the other is the learner-centered approach. I think we often get the idea, at least I think I do, that prophets are always the one that gets style one and I get style two. God talks to the prophets, gives him the information, he writes it down, he's fine, and I'm sitting there waiting for something that doesn't happen, and I got to do all this learner-centered stuff. So I'm the one struggling, and he's the one that's got all the information. The problem, I think, then often occurs is because rather than do the learner-centered stuff, we want to escape it because we don't like the struggle, and it's really awfully difficult, and it's, ooh, too ambiguous. So why not just have that God tell us? Because I like the notebook method. You know, let's write it down. God told me this, what to do. Well, it turns out that our discomfort with that approach will often send us not to God but to other authority figures. And there's a tendency then, I think, for us to find someone to take God's place, to be that teaching assistant who's going to reduce our anxiety by giving us what we want to know. And you know that happens a lot, you know, Koresh and other kinds of demagogic-like individuals take advantage of our need to get the information in that way. And the idea of needing that sort of direct information from God is what makes us more comfortable. But if we're comfortable, we're going to be told what we want to hear, and oftentimes it really turns out not to be what we need to hear. Unfortunately, I think that most experiences that most of us have place us in the position of having to be that learner-centered kind of person. And I think most people struggle with the fact that they're not getting that directly. Let me just tell you quickly about a person that I experienced who had this kind of a conflict. Turns out that you probably know that there are people out there who are having wonderful channeling experiences, meaning that they get a spiritual inspiration that allows them to channel specific revelation about what's going on in the world. This particular fellow came to me because people told me he was hallucinating, and he wanted to be sure he wasn't schizophrenic when he publishes his revelations. And so I was supposed to, you know, say he was clean, and that way the revelations would be just fine. But they would start something like, this is Raphael speaking from the right hand of God, who comes to you to tell you as a worthy servant and to reframe in you the words of the most host of heaven in this last age of the earth, of Dava, to tell you that da-da-da, and these are the kinds of revelations. And they would go on and on about his family. They would go on about things that were happening in the world, about good and evil and the fight and so on and so forth. And he received these through meditation. Now, it was interesting. I mean, see, you should never tell a psychiatrist anything because they always start thinking about other reasons why. But it turns out that this was a man who had been, dominated by his wife for a number of years. Now, that's what he said, so I'm really not just trying to make this a cliche. And he never had any power in his family. And one day he was up meditating, and he had this wonderful sense of the Spirit, and he came back and said, "This is what I feel like." And his wife said, "Well, you're the one that never was going to church. You weren't doing this, you weren't doing that." And so she was really excited, present. She was just that. She said, "You've got to be kidding. God talked to you? And why isn't he talking to me?" And he says, "I don't know." So anyway, after a while, these revelations kept coming more and more. Pretty soon she said, "You've got to be right. You know, you're getting this from God." So she then put him in a position of, he's now the patriarch, and he finally got his place in the family. And pretty soon, he was getting all kinds of revelations. Now, that's a psychiatrist's look at it. It may very well be that those revelations were indeed coming from divine sources. They were individuals that I wasn't aware of. Like I said, some were other names, Vishnu, not Vishnu, but some kind of Vishnu person. And they said there was some kind of spaceship, and these people were circling around the earth. So they started sort of moving in a direction they're not particularly orthodox. But in any case, what was interesting is that he came back in enormous pain a while later and said, "I'm having some real pain about this. Everybody expects me to know what they need to know, and everybody's coming to me for answers." And And in fact, he said, however, the bishop is telling me that, you know, I can't do this, and everybody in the community says I'm this and that, and my wife is absolutely certain that this is from God, and she's taken the whole community on. And she said, we've never been so unhappy in our lives. Now, it was very interesting that what he started out feeling was a direct, you know, inspiration from God in the authoritative model that he used to tell everybody what to do, rather than seeing it as a personal inspiration for himself to discover what he needed to know for himself, became extremely divisive. So my point is that I really think sometimes our need for that authority comes, again, as you say, from something that's inside ourselves, rather than necessarily being a true witness or a true understanding of God himself. We may be projecting ourselves into these things. I don't think he was hallucinating, by the way. The other is the evolutionary basis that Wayne talked about. Let me just say one thing about that. I would rather frame the evolutionary piece that we're talking about in another metaphor. That metaphor is development. And why development is a metaphor for me is because evolution is a systems evolving, and development is an individual involvement evolving over time. And the way I see it is that this is really an individual process in which we all gain more and more insight as we get older. You know, our database increases and we begin to ask different questions and we understand different things. And I look at it as individual growth. I know it has a cultural context in which we as individuals grow to know God, but it's an individual growth as far as necessarily a cultural evolution. You know, for me, for instance, you go as a child and you get a different perspective. And for instance, for me, like Santa Claus was something I was happy to believe in at a time in my life. But, you know, there's a time when I don't believe in that. And that changed over time. Now, I don't find it difficult to tell my children that there's a Santa Claus. I don't know how many of you do, but a lot of people do that, and at some point expect they're going to see it differently. And I think part of the problem is that we have a need to have everything happen in a very clear kind of concrete kind of way, and so we don't let our children know that things develop over time. We expect them to be absolute, and we want it to move absolutely over time. And so we block the process that actually happens to individuals in our thinking because we talk about these things in concrete terms. And when the person starts separating and individuating and saying, I've got to discover some of this myself, we're saying, oh, no, but in this realm, don't. And so consequently, we say, you know, when I told you about Santa Claus, I meant it. And, you know, it hasn't really changed. And yet, you know, at 19, maybe it would be okay to say, no, really, it would be okay to say it's okay for you to discover God, which has to do with an individual process that isn't just, you know, authoritatively based, and help them gain that understanding that that is a process that they are going to go out in and that they can actually learn from. Well, we ought to have a couple of questions. I really appreciated your paper. I want you to know that I feel that that is the style of learning that I want, and that this discovery process is everything, and that I expect I'm going to keep discovering God until I die, and that it will come because I am actively involved in that learning process. Thank you.
We may have brief time for questions. Why don't you stand, please, and ask your question.
My question is...
There are really two phases to the question. I'll repeat it for the tape. One is the process of learning about God not just a circular process that is distorting because we project something out there that we think God is? Is that close to...
If you're not being objective, you have in mind what God is like from the beginning, and you go out to verify that God is indeed the thing that you've made in your mind.
Yeah, it's a heck of a dilemma, isn't it? I don't see any real way around our subjectivity. I don't know that in this life we ever achieve a perfect objectivity. I see us moving in our attempts to learn about God somewhat roughly in the way a scientist would move. You postulate something, you form a hypothesis, and then you test it to see if it works. In this way, I think we observe behaviors that seem to bring good results in the world. And as we observe them, we think, yes, surely this is something that comes from God because it's good, because it has results that seem from our particular perspective here and now to be good results. Can we be confidently assured that we're not off on a byway in projecting this on God? No, I think we can't be assured of that. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that though I think we are enmeshed in subjectively approaching God, I don't see that as being a wholly discouraging thing, nor do I think that we can't grow gradually. Do I think that people at this conference are a long way ahead of some of the primitive tribes contemporary with the old Hebrews in terms of the way they saw God? Yes, I do. And maybe I'm deluding myself, but I think that culturally there is some slow, gradual progress that gets made. And I think we just have to be comfortable with that. The question that you asked was, where do I see God in this process? Has he arrived at some ultimate perfection, or is he still in process? And I'll take a Kierkegaardian posture on that and say that that's the infinite from my perspective, and I won't even presume to speculate about it.
Well, let me just say about your first question, I just want to make the comment that, again, I have a lot of experience with young people who experience God in the way they experience their parents. And believe me, it's a very real thing, that if they had an abusive parent, often they project this onto God as a kind of very demanding, controlling, a woman in incest with her father began to see God clearly as someone who would take advantage of her, that she always felt that she never had anything. So there was this huge peace for some people as we get enmeshed in our own developmental experience to somehow grow beyond that and become objective. So I think your question is very, very real. I think there's a frightening degree of enmeshment all of us have, and how do we grow out of that, I think, is an enormous challenge. I would just say one thing that, to me, in each of these individuals is a key thing that changes sometimes my ability to relate to that, and that is I think and I feel and I have faith that there's a divine center in every person, and that bit of divinity is the sort of like the God seed. I mean, that's a terrible word, but the fact is that there is something in them that knows what God is because they have the potential to become like that. And to the degree that they look within themselves to feel that which is in harmony with spirit, that they can feel from the outside as well, they begin to value that which is really good. And when they seek to do that, they seem to get to know God in a different way. Well, objectivity probably would have to be put down in, by their fruits ye shall know them. And it's the law of the harvest. That would be the most objective way. That is, by the selection of those things that they think to be good, they plant the seed and they see its outcome. That is their objective measure as to what they planted was good or not.
I think we could spend another half hour with questions, but I've been given strict instructions to end on time, so we thank Wayne Scow and Richard Ferry for their wonderful remarks, and if you can catch them afterwards, you can come and ask them some of your questions. Thank you.